chronic pain patients. They have to learn it's their body, their pain, their health. The work is done by them. Bonico's proteges at the University of Washington were suggesting a comprehensive approach to treating pain, in which opiates played only a small role. By the early 1990s, hundreds of clinics in America followed the UW model. Yet, almost from the beginning, insurance companies balked. In time, they stopped funding crucial parts of multidisciplinary treatment that weren't strictly medical, physical, occupational, and psychological therapy in particular. Loescher and his staff battled them incessantly. He would show the companies that the patients became healthier, and this saved the companies money in the long run. But the people making the funding decisions have nothing whatsoever to do with health, Loescher said. They were more and more restrictive in what they would pay for. Thus, doctors were increasingly deprived of some crucial tools to treat that pain, just as patients were taught to believe that they had a right to pain relief. The Man Comes, Los Angeles, California. The man had come out of the West, dusty and wizened. His grandfather, whose name he bore but whom he never knew, had two women, two families, one in Phoenix, the other in New Mexico. His father's half-brother, whom he never knew, was murdered by Pablo Acosta, a weed smuggler and the first Mexican drug lord. In 1939, the man's father moved the family from New Mexico to California. The agricultural town of Brawley in California's Imperial Valley was a pit stop for Depression migrants taking the southern route into the Golden State. His parents worked on the Brawley farm of a relative, and during this time, the man was born. Then they moved to Fresno, where his father became a farm labor contractor. His parents separated when he was 13. He went with his mother to Van Nuys in the San Fernando Valley of Los Angeles. They found a house in the Van Nuys barrio, a place without sidewalks or much police presence. This being the 1950s, Mexican Americans and the valley's sea of white people rarely ventured out of their barrios unless it was to go to work. Families in Barrio Van Nuys owned their homes. The men were employed in the lower rungs of the movie industry or as city and country workers, paving roads, landscaping public buildings. They hung out after work at the neighborhood store and drank beer under pepper trees. The man dropped out of Van Nuys High, got his diploma at a continuation school. By then, he was also trafficking, cutting up pounds of weed and selling joints in the neighborhood. When pills, whites, reds, bennies, became the fashion, he drove to Tijuana, stayed all weekend, bought jars of them, and tripled his money back in Van Nuys. He liked to think that he was something of a shot caller among his generation. He was 19. About then, he started using heroin. Many of the young men in Barrio Van Nuys used it, and most of them died young. He became a steam fitter later, and had other jobs, two marriages, and children. But mostly he was, as he put it years later, a drug merchant. He liked to see himself as sticking it to the establishment, living outside the law. He served several prison terms. It usually took less than 48 hours of freedom before he was shooting up again. Not much mattered to him but the drug. He bought houses for his family, his kids. Mostly, though, money was to be used to get more dope. About the only other thing that held his interest for so many years was gambling on NFL games. What bedeviled him was a reliable source of heroin supply. His sources had always been difficult to maintain. People were always going to jail, or he was, or they died. Either way, it was always a battle to find consistently good quality heroin in large amounts. In the 1970s, he met a guy, a relative of a lieutenant of Ernesto Don Neto Fonseca. Fonseca was a grizzled Mexican drug kingpin who later gained infamy and a life prison term for his part in organizing the Sinaloa drug cartel. Fonseca's nephew, Rafael Caro Quintero, joined him behind bars for arranging the torture killing of DEA agent Enrique Kiki Camarena in 1985. The man and his contact took the train down to Mexico to buy a kilo from Fonseca. They met the legendary capo in the hotel he built in downtown Culiacan, the sweltering capital of Sinaloa, the birthplace of Mexican trafficking. "I'm gonna give you this kilo and see what you guys can do with it up there," Fonseca told them. "I'd like to open up a market up there. You guys do right, and I'll keep supplying you." For 4 months, they did Don Neto right, and he kept sending them kilos. Then they were arrested, and the Fonseca connection disappeared. The man found other sources in Mexicali, which didn't last long either. But all that was years ago. When I met him, the man was slowed by a liver problem. His eyelids often hung at half-mast. Years of trafficking, gambling, and spiking his veins had sapped him, in his 70s, of any real mirth. He never read novels, only nonfiction. His laugh issued from him as a dry chuckle, thin as cardboard. But when he was in his late 50s, he had happened on a scheme that would, in his eyes, make his life worthwhile. It involved bringing black tar heroin to new people and places east of the Mississippi River. He had blown into these cities across America like a wind, a different name in every town, in old used cars that were gray or beige. He left behind a drug that would change these places and bring misery to thousands of families. Through the 1990s, that drug, in turn, transformed the small Mexican town of Jalisco, Nayarit, a place he would come to view as his own, where he would buy property and keep a woman. He was a contemporary of David Tejeda, whom he knew, though not well. Tejeda was among the pioneers to ignite the first stage of the Jalisco heroin expansion in the early 1990s. The man began the second, in 1998. So after I tracked him down, I visited him often and listened to him talk about the past. He held the answer, I came to realize, to how black tar heroin crossed the Mississippi River to stay. He liked to think himself a hero to the young men from the small town of Jalisco, Nayarit, whom he recruited and taught to retail the drug. "I'd have fathers and mothers come ask me for work for their sons, knowing exactly what they were going to do, exactly what I did," he said one day in the living room of his Central Valley home. "These are people who are dirt poor. They see all these other young kids with new trucks, building houses, mothers and fathers driving around in a half-nice pickup, then the kids bugging them. I want to go up north." Initially, the market they sold to was older addicts like him, the heroin underworld that had survived since the 1970s, when the drug was last popular. But as it happened, illicit use of another drug, a pharmaceutical called OxyContin, was creating a vast new market for heroin among middle and upper-class white people, folks with money. When he heard about OxyContin, he began to follow it, knowing that if he did, he would soon have a market. The relentless Jalisco retail delivery system evolved as it fed on this ever-growing base of customers addicted to OxyContin in America and on the deep frustration of young, landless, working-class men in Mexico. These men did not form a cartel. They could not. The envidia, small-town jealousy, and the wild bronco attitudes that rule Mexican ranchos prevented grand organizations from forming. "Families cannot work together," the man told me. "We're real envious of each other." But precisely because they could not, their heroin system became pernicious and successful. It aroused the entrepreneurial spirit of rancheros, young and driven, as it harnessed a cheap and addictive product to the power of small-scale free market capitalism. The system marked a radical departure in the way Mexican traffickers sold and profited from dope, and it challenged U.S. law enforcement. "We didn't start the heroin dealing business. We just used a different method," the man said. "We weren't a cartel. We were all different cells. Everybody's their own group. There's the boss of each little group. They all work individually. There's some heavy dudes, some who are mediocre and some who are trying to make it. Some go bust. Some got a lot." The Revolution. In 1986, Russell Portnoy, then 31, and his mentor, Kathy Foley, published what became a Declaration of Independence for the vanguard of pain specialists interested in using opiates for chronic pain, though Portnoy hardly intended it as such. Other researchers had been issuing papers saying that many chronic pain patients using opiates invariably ended up addicted. Portnoy and Foley hadn't seen that. They reviewed the cases of 38 of their cancer patients with chronic pain who used opiate painkillers. Only 2 grew addicted, and they had histories of drug abuse. The rest functioned well, and most of them without pain to boot. Portnoy and Foley wrote a paper reporting those observations and submitted it to a medical journal called Pain. Opiates themselves were not inherently addictive, the author suggested. A lot depended on the people taking them. Cited among the footnotes supporting the paper was a letter to the editor by Jane Porter and Dr. Herschel Jick out of Boston in a 1980 edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. It was headlined, "Addiction Rare in Patients Treated with Narcotics." The idea in the pain paper, Portnoy said later, was that these drugs have certain characteristics which, when interacting with a certain kind of brain, can lead to bad outcomes. But it's not inherent in the pill such that everybody given the pill becomes an addict. From that gradually grew the idea that opiates might be prescribed not only to people dying from cancer but to others, perhaps those with chronic pain, a far more controversial idea. The paper warned against prescribing them for patients with a history of drug abuse. In later interviews and research, Portnoy made clear he believed a doctor needed to spend a good deal of time with each patient, delving into his or her medical and family history. He described a questionnaire a doctor should give to patients to determine the risk of addiction in each individual. He proposed 2 famous extremes: a teetotaling 70-plus-year-old woman with bleeding ulcers and osteoarthritis, and a 20-something kid who smoked weed for several years, has tattoos on his back, and suffers chronic pain in his knees from surgery a year before. The former was at far less risk of opiate addiction than the latter. Yet most of the decisions a family doctor had to make, for family docs were on the front lines in prescribing pain relievers, were far more complicated. What about the 40-year-old construction worker with a brother in jail who in his early 20s drank a lot, but who is successfully raising a family and suffers from chronic back pain? That pain paper, which Portnoy believed would be forgotten, was instead feverishly debated. With Foley and Sloan Kettering's name on the paper, it convulsed the consensus against the limited use of opiates. Portnoy was attacked personally. Treating chronic pain with opiates went against so many long-held medical beliefs. The drugs were dangerous and addictive, many felt, when used that way. One researcher wrote to Payne, claiming Portnoy and Foley did not understand the nature of pain. The anger that that paper generated and people buttonholing me at conferences and telling me that I was a bad guy and stuff that makes that even sound good, Portnoy later told an interviewer. It was really an interesting time to live through. Against this vehement reaction, Foley and Portnoy viewed themselves as warriors on the patient's behalf, cracking a tired prohibitionist dogma that had outlived its usefulness, particularly as technology and drugs advanced. Nodes of support for their position emerged around the country. One was Salt Lake City. Lynn Webster's acute pain service at Holy Cross Hospital was only part of it. Pain researchers and clinics congregated in Utah, seeking other ways of treating pain patients. The state's Mormon population stayed put, so clinicians could do a study on a group of people, followed by another 5 years later, and 5 years after that with the same people. Moreover, while many Utahns, as Mormons, didn't consume caffeine, nicotine, and other drugs, the clandestine use of prescription pills, primarily painkillers, had taken hold, giving clinicians ample opportunity to study addiction. Among the people eager for a new approach to pain treatment was Webster's nurse, Marcia Stanton. Stanton was raised a Christian Scientist but went to nursing school. She grew into her career in the 1960s and 1970s, years when physicians and medical instructors insisted on the chary use of opiates, no matter the patient. We were all, nurses, pharmacists, physicians, taught, don't overdose, don't overdose. You give the smallest amount of medication over the longest period of time because you don't want to give a patient too much for fear of addiction. But during the 1980s, medications and technology were making new treatment possible. Old attitudes began to fade. From Utah, Webster, Michael Ashburn, Perry Fine, Brad Hare, and Richard Chapman emerged as pain clinicians and thought leaders, along with Portnoy and others in New York. Soon, a critical mass was reached, and an effervescent pain management scene developed in Salt Lake. This new Salt Lake pain vanguard held monthly meetings that attracted 100 people at a time to listen to speakers, discuss new techniques in pain management, and put the old days behind them. Salt Lake City became one of the meccas for the new and innovative kinds of things, said Stanton. We were interested in better patient care. What we had done for all these years wasn't working. I remember lecturing many, many times saying I feel so badly that I treated patients so poorly for so long, but we have the technology now that we didn't have before. An idea advanced that pain counteracted opiate's euphoric effect and thus reduced the risk of addiction. In a statement on its website, the American Pain Society claimed that risk of addiction was low when opiates are used to treat patients in pain. There appeared to be no ceiling on the dose of opiate painkillers a pain patient might take. Pain, the APS went on, acted against the tendency of opiates to stop the lungs from breathing. Thus, withholding the drugs, on the basis of respiratory concerns, is unwarranted. Changes in attitudes and techniques in pain treatment were coming quickly. Anesthesiologists found a new role in medicine. Before, anesthesiologists left the patient after surgery. Now they could accompany patients through days or weeks of post-operative recovery, tending to new techniques, such as the epidural that Lynn Webster had given Dorothy. More anesthesiologists became pain specialists. Specialists required nurses. American Society for Pain Management Nursing, formed in 1990, funded largely by the Baxter Company, and within a couple years had more than 2,000 members. In 1996, the president of the American Pain Society, Dr. James Campbell, said in a speech that, "If pain were assessed with the same zeal as other vital signs are, it would have a much better chance of being treated properly. We need to train doctors and nurses to treat pain as a vital sign." The American Pain Society trademarked the slogan, "Pain, the fifth vital sign," and used it to promote the idea that doctors should attend to pain as routinely as to the other vital signs. In 1998, the Veterans Health Administration made pain a fifth vital sign, another gauge of a patient's baseline health, along with pulse, blood pressure, body temperature, and respiration. The Joint Commission for Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, GCAHO, which accredits 16,000 healthcare organizations in the United States, did the same. Hospitals were now to be judged on how they assessed and treated a patient's pain. The California legislature required hospitals and nursing homes to screen for pain along with other vital signs. The state's Board of Pharmacy was by then assuring members that studies show opiates have an extremely low potential for abuse when used correctly. From all this, the idea took hold that America was under-treating pain. Tens of millions of people, surveys reported, were in pain that wasn't being treated. Pain's under-treatment was viewed as an unnecessary epidemic, for medicine now had tools to treat it. A 2001 survey of 1,000 people living at home with pain due to a medical condition reported, half couldn't remember what it felt like to not be in pain. 40% said pain was constant, and 22% said they suffered severe pain. Only 13% had seen a pain specialist. Doctors and medical associations, however, were worried. Prescribing these drugs might lead to addiction. They demanded legal clarity. So, beginning with California, states passed laws exempting doctors from prosecution if they prescribed opiates for pain within the practice of responsible health care. Numerous states approved so-called intractable pain regulations, Ohio, Oregon, Washington, and others. Soon what can only be described as a revolution in medical thought and practice was underway. Doctors were urged to begin attending to the country's pain epidemic by prescribing these drugs. Interns and residents were taught that these drugs were now not addictive, that doctors thus had a mission, a duty, to use them. In some hospitals, doctors were told they could be sued if they did not treat pain aggressively, which meant with opiates. Russell Portnoy, meanwhile, was made director of the Pain Medicine and Palliative Care Department at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City, the country's first such department at a major hospital. From this vantage point, and with funding from several drug companies, he pressed a campaign to destigmatize opiates. The drug company Baxter and others produced intravenous patient-controlled analgesia, PCA, pumps, allowing patients to administer their own painkiller with the push of a button. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, two pediatric nurses, Donna Wong and her colleague, Connie Baker, sought a way of assessing pain in children who had trouble describing what they felt. Wong was incorrectly diagnosed with leukemia as a child and subjected to painful operations without the aid of analgesics. She became a nurse. In the 1980s, with the smiley face fad in recent memory, the women devised a series of six faces a child could point to. The chart begins with a smiling face and ends with a tearful, grimacing face. The Wong-Baker Faces Scale is now a standard in gauging pain in children. There are other versions for adults. Patients are asked to quantify their pain according to a scale, numbered from 0 to 10, 10 being worst. These scales were highly subjective, but they were about the only pain measurement tools medicine had to offer. Crucial implements in the revolution were Press-Ganey surveys. Designed by a physician and a statistician, the surveys gauged patient satisfaction with their doctors. The surveys were a reasonable idea. They became widely used at U.S. hospitals in the 1990s as patient rights grew paramount, and the JCAHO began aggressively measuring how hospitals treated patient pain. Through all this, patients were getting used to demanding drugs for treatment. They did not, however, have to accept the idea that they might, say, eat better and exercise more, and that this might help them lose weight and feel better. Doctors, of course, couldn't insist, as the defenestration of the physician's authority and clinical experience was underway. Patients didn't have to take accountability for their own behavior. All this happened in about a decade. In a country where doctors once feared opiates, a culture of aggressive opiate use was emerging by the mid-1990s. This had support from several quarters: pain specialists and medical school professors, the JCAHO, the drug companies, even hospital lawyers, and so on. Ideas cross-pollinated at the pain conferences that now sprouted around the United States, supported by the pharmaceutical companies that had new medications and technologies to sell. Like-minded people met and questioned old therapies and authorities. At the core of this culture was the idea that these painkillers were virtually non-addictive when used to treat pain. Proponents of this approach tried to embed it with nuance. The VHA cited patients' homelessness, PTSD, injuries, and substance abuse in advising that the complexity of chronic pain management is often beyond the expertise of a single practitioner. Primary care doctors should consult pain specialists and multidisciplinary pain clinics. One paper in the International Association for the Study of Pain called pain assessment not an isolated event but an ongoing process, which evolved with new evidence and patient input. The fifth vital sign was a concept, not a guide for pain assessment, one report read. Along with the pain number scale, a doctor ought to ask numerous questions about a patient's pain history, the pain's location, severity, impact on daily life, as well as the patient's family history, substance abuse, psychological issues, and so on. In fact, pain was really not a vital sign, after all. For unlike the four real vital signs, it cannot be measured objectively and with exactitude. The National Pharmaceutical Council advised that the manner in which information is elicited from the patient is important, Ideally, the clinician should afford ample time. Let the patient tell the story in his or her own words and ask open-ended questions. Time was the key. Chronic pain patients took more time than most to diagnose. Problem was, doctors had less time. Just as patient rights were emphasized and surveys were circulating asking them to judge their doctor's performance, patients were in fact losing their most precious medical commodity, time with their doctors. With the managed care movement of the 1980s and 1990s, insurance companies cut costs and reduced what services they'd pay for. They require that patients give up their long-time physicians for those on a list of approved providers. They negotiated lower fees with doctors. To make up the difference, primary care docs had to fit more patients into a day. A Newsweek story claimed that to do a good job, a primary care doctor ought to have a roster of 1,800 patients. The average load today is 2,300, with some seeing up to 3,000. The way you're reimbursed in a day, if you actually take the time to treat someone's pain, you'd be out of business, one longtime family doc told me. By the model you're stuck in, you can't do it. The hospital will get rid of you. If you're by yourself, you can't pay for your secretary. So as the movement to destigmatize opiates and use them for chronic pain gained energy, the seeds of discontent were already being sown. These drugs were advertised mostly to primary care physicians who had little pain management training and were making their money by churning patients through their office at a 13-minute clip. Not much time for nuance. Not much time for listening or for open-ended questions that might elicit long and complicated answers. On the contrary, just as Valium helped doctors deal with anxious patients in the 1960s, opiates helped a harried doctor with what was now the largest drain on his time, chronic pain patients. As the movement gained strength from new drugs and devices, the crucial ingredient in pain management, the amount of time a doctor could spend with each patient, fell. Digging through all this, I found at least two studies that showed that prescribing of all kinds rose as doctor visits shortened. Not surprising, as every doctor knows, nothing cuts short a patient visit like a prescription pad. The Prestganey patient surveys, it turned out, had an unintended effect in this context. It was to subtly pressure doctors to write unnecessary scripts for opiates. A doctor reluctant to write them was more likely to get a poor patient evaluation. Too many bad scores, and a hospital began asking questions. I get raises and keep my job based on whether I'm keeping my patients happy, said a nursing supervisor I spoke with. When the Joint Commission surveyed us, they looked through charts looking at pain. They were looking at other things, but pain was the number one thing. They just hammered and hammered on pain. You had to control everybody's pain. The Prestganey scores were the one way they measured how the doctors were doing. And there was another problem. No one had done serious, long-term studies of whether opiates actually were non-addictive when used by such patients. Years later, in fact, there still is no evidence of how many chronic pain patients can be successfully treated with opiates without growing dependent, then addicted. Determining who is a good candidate for opium treatment is a mystery, and particularly difficult when doctors have no pain management training and only 13 minutes with each patient. The new pain movement pushed past these doubts. It acquired a quasi-religious fervor among people seared by the non-treatment of pain of years past. A pendulum began to swing. The cruelty of earlier days discredited those who might question the emerging doctrine of opiates for chronic pain. Pain specialists working toward a new day felt gratitude to pharmaceutical companies for developing the drugs and devices that made possible the humane treatment of pain. Among them was Purdue Frederick, which in 1991 formed an associated company, Purdue Pharma, that in turn grew into a leader in timed-release pain medications. Purdue was unknown to the public, but well-known to pain specialists. It was leading the way with new tools in pain treatment, MS-Contin above all, but with other drugs on the way. The company also had attempted to control theft by developing a database to aid law enforcement investigations into pharmacy robberies. For those of us doing pain management, That was the ultimate. Purdue was the company, Marcia Stanton said. They had done everything right. They'd blown onto the market. They had supported the clinicians, supported the education. They had done everything we thought they should have. Purdue, in particular, funded pain researchers, many of whom saw the company as an innovator and ally. This included Russell Portnoy. Portnoy, in turn, spoke frequently and with passion at conferences of primary care doctors, urging them to consider new approaches to pain that included opiates and timed-release opiates in particular. Years after his pain paper, suggesting that pain patients treated with opiates might not be at risk of addiction, Portnoy said it was based on weak, weak, weak data, and called it a little paper that turned into an important paper. Nevertheless, with that 1986 paper, a debate among researchers broke wide open. That debate quaked medical practice and changed the lives of people oblivious to these discussions going on in the corridors of hospitals and medical academia. The great new question of pain management was, can opiate painkillers be used without risk of addiction by chronic pain patients who would live for years, in the same way that these drugs were now used on patients dying of cancer? With crusaders' confidence, and fed in part by the discovery of what was increasingly called a report in the New England Journal of Medicine, co-authored by a Boston doctor named Herschel Jick, more and more people, especially Dr. Russell Portnoy and salespeople from a little-known pharmaceutical company, Purdue Pharma, which was about to release a new painkiller, answered yes. All About the 501s, Boise, Idaho. From what Ed Rupplinger could tell, there was nothing dumb about Poya. Poya was a Mexican in his mid-40s. He was about 5'9", and the type of guy who could have easily grown heavy had he not gone to the gym, which he did a lot. Poya was trim, conservative, respectable, and looked to the world like a small businessman. He had a wife back in Mexico who nagged him about doing the books, about making sure the flow of inventory was reliable, and that his salesmen weren't abusing their expense accounts out in the field. Poya's real name was Cesar Garcia Langarica. He was in the black tar heroin business, and he was from Jalisco, Nayarit, on Mexico's Pacific coast. It was 1995, and Ed Rupplinger was a narcotics investigator with a drug task force in Boise, Idaho. Poya's young workers were both the source of his profits and the bane of his existence. Motivating them while he was out of town took most of his working hours. He did this without threat or coercion, and handled their misadventures with patience, it seemed to Rupplinger. When one of them crashed into a sign outside the complex where Poya had rented them an apartment, he appeared at the manager's office the next day with money to pay for the damage. Rupplinger heard this story from the apartment complex manager. Through the 1990s, the Jalisco system had refined through trial and error. The boys compared notes at barbecues back in Jalisco, and slowly a set of rules evolved that was passed along like folklore. One rule: no violence. At the time, the best-known drug gangs, the Bloods and Crips, shot it out over crack cocaine on street corners in towns far from Los Angeles, garnering police attention wherever they went. Watching all this, the Jalisco boys quietly began to expand nationwide by doing exactly the opposite. Poya was part of that 1990s expansion, and one place he showed up was Boise. Rupplinger's interest was first piqued when the drug unit suddenly began arresting Mexican drivers tooling around town selling heroin in balloons they kept in their mouths. They were easy to spot and bust, particularly with the help of addicts who, once arrested, were terrified of withdrawing in jail, as Dennis Chavez had seen in Denver, and as drug agents elsewhere would later discover. Rupplinger noticed that these Mexican drivers often had only a small amount of heroin and no weapons, so they never did much jail time. But it struck Rupplinger's best police nerve that whenever he could determine where they were from, it turned out that they were from a state in Mexico called Nayarit. What's more, these guys were replaced within a couple of days. After a while, Rupplinger realized it didn't matter how many Nayarit heroin drivers his task force arrested. More drivers filled the open slots. anybody could have taken the case, but Ed Ruplinger alone set about trying to answer the questions that arose as the Ada Metro Narcotics Task Force arrested more and more of these drivers. Who was behind them? He wondered. It was way too organized. This could not be unique to Boise, which was no one's natural choice of a place to start up a drug-dealing enterprise. It had to have started somewhere else. Ruplinger had been puzzling this out for a few weeks and not getting very far when he first noticed Garcia Langarica's name. It surfaced on the apartment records of these drivers, or the cars they drove. One day, Ruplinger watched a driver swing by an apartment building and pass a trim fellow some money. Here, clearly, was the boss, Ruplinger thought. Yet the first time Ruplinger and his colleagues followed Poya, the suspected ringleader walked into a Mexican restaurant and took his place as a cook behind the grill. The man Ruplinger took for a heroin kingpin appeared instead to be a simple cook and not worth the unit's time. But Ruplinger's hunch proved correct. 1 month later, Garcia Langarica quit the job. From then on, when Poya was in town, he spent all his time supervising his heroin drivers. Poya's drivers had been operating for a while and seemed to have Boise to themselves. Then a sharp-eyed postal inspector, just before Christmas 1996, came upon a package that alerted a drug-sniffing dog. Inside was a Santa Claus doll, and inside the doll was black tar heroin. The local narcotics task force, which included Ruplinger, had the parcel delivered to the apartment it was addressed to. A Boise drug team burst in and found four well-dressed middle-aged Mexican men sitting around a card table, already breaking up the heroin into small packets. They, too, were all from the state of Nayarit, last name of Tejeda. The Santa Claus bust actually marked the beginning of the end of Poya's dominion over Boise. Ruplinger figured that word of Boise had spread among the Nayarit heroin traffickers, and crew after crew descended on the town to compete with Poya in what he had set up in Idaho's capital. One of Poya's former drivers ran a new cell, Ruplinger was amazed to note. He had gone back to Mexico, then returned to Boise with his own drivers, a dispatcher, and a supply source to compete head-to-head with his former boss. Poya was one of the founding fathers. He comes in and sets it all up, Ruplinger said when we met in Boise. The word gets out back home. Then every operative in Nayarit ends up moving in. Much later, as I continued to piece through the story of the Jalisco boys, I met a woman who said she was married to one of the drivers who worked for Poya back in the mid-1990s. Poya, she said, started in the San Fernando Valley, but competition pushed him to move his cells to Pomona and Ontario, 40 miles east of Los Angeles. His drivers often hung out at her mother's restaurant in Pomona, she said. There, she met one of Poya's drivers, married him, and had children with him. They visited Jalisco twice. When we met, she told me that her now ex-husband had helped start a cell for Poya in Salt Lake City in the 1990s, then broke off and began competing with him. Her brother-in-law helped open Boise for Poya, then also started his own cell there, in competition with his ex-boss. At the time, the cities had only small populations of heroin addicts, people scrounging every day to get their fix. A stagnant market left only one place to get customers. We were just poaching from Poya, she said. We would make the balloons bigger to attract his customers. Then we'd give specials, $6 for $100 instead of just $5. It was a back-and-forth competition. Don't go with them. We can give you a better deal. But as we talked, what she told me about her ex and his family intrigued me even more. He came from a family that had land and farm animals. They grew sugarcane and made cheese. They were middle class by the standards of Mexican farm communities, she said. I expected most of these traffickers had come from the dirt-poorest families. That was true of the drivers, particularly those who came later, she said. But most of the heroin pioneers of Jalisco County were the sons of farmers who were pretty well off, again by Mexican agricultural standards. They had some money to invest. With resources also came broader horizons of what was possible and what they wanted or expected from life. Selling heroin was just easier than growing sugarcane. It was more adventurous and involved more cash. It gave them the means to build better houses, and this set off a construction boom across Jalisco County that employed dozens, if not hundreds, of construction workers by the end of the 1990s. The houses went up in a few months, not in a decade. No house in downtown Jalisco had rebar extending from the top of it. That was the difference between Jalisco and every other Mexican immigrant town. Jalisco had notably less rebar. Then she said something strange. After building their houses and providing for their families, what the guys she knew from Jalisco, Nayarit, seemed to want most of all were Levi's 501s. Levi's 501s were the pantswear gold standard for men in Mexico ranchos in the 1990s. They were very expensive in Mexico. One thing that made the Jalisco Boys' retail system so popular, and young men eager to work in it, was that the system provided a way to accumulate quantities, large stacks, of 501s very cheaply. That was because U.S. junkies soon learned these dealers' tastes and offered endless supplies of shoplift 501s in exchange for their daily dope. Before long, the junkies took orders according to size and color and traded them two for one. Two pairs of 501s for one $20 balloon of black tar. While she was married into the Jalisco world, it was more about the jeans than anything, she told me. From day one, any opportunity to barter for jeans, they'd take it. They had stacks of jeans. They'd bring home exactly the sizes people wanted. The thirst for Levi's 501s, she said, is part of what propelled the Jalisco system as it began to expand out of the San Fernando Valley and through the western United States in the mid-1990s. Back in the ranchos, nothing said that a man had moved up in the world like walking around in public in dark blue 501s. Seeing others in brand new Levi's 501s, meanwhile, inspired many youngsters, who had only thin, cheap jeans, if they had any at all, to hire on as drivers. The more I asked about Levi's 501s as fuel to the expansion of the Jalisco heroin networks, the more people had to say about it. I once brought home 50 pairs of Levi's in suitcases, which I took with me coming down on the bus from California, said one Jalisco trafficker who worked crews from San Fernando Valley to Columbus and was eventually made manager of a crew in Denver as well. I'd get them from clients who'd steal them from Sears. Many dealers like me were bringing back big quantities of Levi's. I'd give them away to friends and my family. But then after a while, they started demanding them. Send me this, send me that. Then they wanted shirts, tennis shoes. They wanted everything. Levi's 501s were, in fact, part of a larger Keep Up with the Joneses competition that heroin revenue fueled back in the small town. Very quickly, the families got caught up in this. Around town, the gossip would start weeks in advance. So-and-so's coming home with gifts, and then we're going to kill a cow and he's going to pay for the banda. Every trafficker's return was like Christmas Day, as relatives lined up for gifts, especially those jeans. Some traffickers came pulling trailers full of clothes. The family wants more and more and more, so the guys start feeling the pressure, the ex-wife I interviewed told me. Give me, you need to provide for me. Their own family starts thinking they deserve this. My ex's sister was demanding, you need to give me this, or you need to give me that. Whatever's yours is mine. My ex used to send all kinds of clothes home. First it was 501s, but then later it was, I want Guess jeans, then Tommy Hilfiger's. Just as an addict couldn't choose not to use dope, these men couldn't not return to sell it. Up north, they slept on the floors of apartments, unwilling to invest even in a mattress, awaiting the day when they could go home bearing gifts. Once back in Jalisco, she said, they walked the town the object of other men's envy, paying for the banda and the beer, and surrounded by women. And no driver ever wanted to miss the Feria del Elote in August. That's when you get to show off the most, she said. It's like a kid going to Disneyland for the first time. They walk around with their chest out. Everybody looks at them. I imagine their mu receptors jolted in endorphins. They live for it. They save their frickin' pennies for it, she said. It's a euphoria. They get high on it. They're in fantasy land, in a dream where they think they're the kings, until the money runs out. Thus, with an addict's energy and single-mindedness, she said, the Jalisco boys sought new markets and higher profit margins, awaiting the chance to go back home, the kings of their dreamland for a week or two, Only the self-centeredness of addiction, she said, explained how farm boys from a traditional and conservative small town could sell a product, anathema to their parents, to sad-eyed, vulnerable junkies, and not be tormented. I used to work in a laboratory where they did research on animals and have to kill them, the ex-wife said. The way you deal with that is that you disassociate yourself from that animal. You don't let it get to you. You put up that barrier. That's what they do. They do that with people. Ed Rupplinger struggled to keep up as more crews started up in Boise. He created timelines and flowcharts of connections between Poya and drivers and other U.S. cities. Others in the unit thought he was crazy. When had Boise figured in any kind of international narcotics conspiracy? Plus, so many Hispanic names wearied the mind. Rupplinger got permission to run wiretaps on Poya's phones. The extent of Poya's business then grew clearer. He had crews in Portland, too, and in Salt Lake City and Honolulu. Salt Lake did more business than Boise. Rupplinger heard Poya complain that he left Denver because it got so he couldn't make any money with these crews from his hometown competing for the same addicts. New sales took his clients, and to win them back, he had to lower his prices. Rupplinger marveled at how massive and connected the Jalisco network was. Poya's heroin store practiced just-in-time supply, with women as mules every couple weeks bringing up a pound of heroin at a time. Keen to keep customers at bay, Poya insisted that his drivers provide excellent customer service. Once, when a driver reported a customer complaint of a bad batch of dope, Poya promised to make it right. The driver delivered better quality stuff to the client the next day. When Rupplinger heard that, he felt he was watching the expansion of some new, scary thing, as if he were all alone in a lab where a virus had escaped its test tube. One day, Rupplinger heard one of the drivers tell Poya that he was afraid of delivering to the nearby town of Caldwell because the gangs there scared him. Poya told him he'd handle it. The conversation stayed with Rupplinger, who had worked in Southern California and knew that the gangs in tiny Caldwell were but faint echoes of gangs elsewhere. What kind of drug crew was this that was scared of the wannabe gangs of Caldwell, Idaho? Every narcotics agent in the 1990s had the Bloods and Crips crack warfare as a precedent, and the Colombian cocaine cowboys in Miami before that. The Nayarites weren't that way. With faith in their addictive product, they didn't need to shoot it out for territory. These drivers knew each other and would stop to chat or meet for lunch. Even as they competed and drove down each other's prices, they did so in peace. They went out of their way to avoid attention. It helped that the drivers had no investment in how much they sold and that they didn't use. There was no incentive for them to cut their dope. They didn't make any more money if they cut it than if they sold it as it came. They were employees, guys on a salary, with their costs covered and a stipend of several hundred dollars a week. The last thing they wanted was violence. In 2 years, from 1995 to 1997, Boise's minor market had a half dozen crews selling heroin like pizza. But that wasn't all. From the wiretaps, Rupplinger heard Poya call Phoenix, Ontario, El Monte, Salt Lake, Portland, Billings, Las Vegas, Honolulu. If Boise had a half dozen, how many crews must Denver have? What about Portland? Las Vegas? The heroin cells were like ants in a garden. You didn't see them unless you got close enough and knew what to look for. Then, even when you stamped them out, more came to take their place. It was 1997. Well before most other cops in the country, Ed Rupplinger was figuring out how to see the ants. The Landmark Study. By the 1990s, it would have alarmed Dr. Herschel Jick out in Boston to know that his letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, which he had long forgotten, had become a foundation for a revolution in U.S. medical practice. This was wildly beyond anything Herschel Jick intended when he penned it. But that's what happened. The revolution extended to hospitals, medical clinics, and family practices across the country. It's unclear who retrieved the Porter and Jick letter from obscurity, but it appears to have been cited first as a footnote in Kathy Foley and Russell Portnoy's 1986 paper in Pain. In time, the paragraph became known simply as Porter and Jick. That shorthand, in turn, lent prestige to the tiny thing, and the claim attributed to it, that less than 1% of patients treated with narcotics develop addictions to them. That less than 1% statistic stuck. But a crucial point was lost. Jick's database consisted of hospitalized patients from years when opiates were strictly controlled in hospitals and given in tiny doses to those suffering the most acute pain, all overseen by doctors. These were not chronic pain patients going home with bottles of pain pills. It was a bizarre misinterpretation, for Jick's letter really supported a contrary claim, that when used in hospitals for acute pain, and then when mightily controlled, opiates rarely produce addiction. Nevertheless, its message was transformed into that broad headline, "Addiction Rare in Patients Treated with Narcotics." Others began citing its purported claim. Marcia Stanton remembers citing Porter and Jick frequently in educational seminars that she gave through the 1990s to doctors and nurses on pain treatment. Everybody heard it everywhere. It was Porter and Jick. We all used it. We all thought it was gospel. A lot went into making it so. Porter and Jick appeared in that Bible of scholarly and journalistic rectitude, the New England Journal of Medicine. Medical professionals assumed everyone had read it. But only in 2010 did the NEJM put all its archives online. Before that, the archives only went back to 1993. To actually look up Porter and Jick, to discover that it was a one-paragraph letter to the editor and not a scientific study, required going to a medical school library and digging up the actual issue, which took time most doctors didn't have. Instead, primary care docs took the word of pain specialists, who pointed to Porter and Jick as evidence that opiates were far less addictive for chronic pain patients than previously thought. Not that primary care doctors needed much encouragement. Chronic pain patients, desperate for relief, could be insistent, rude, and abusive to staff, and took a lot of time to diagnose and treat. Physicians had a mantra: one chronic pain patient can ruin your whole day. Now a solution was at hand. That single paragraph, buried in the back pages of the New England Journal of Medicine, was mentioned, lectured on, and cited until it emerged transformed into, in the words of one textbook, a landmark report that did much to counteract fears of addiction in pain patients treated with opiates. It did nothing of the kind. In a 1989 monograph for the National Institutes of Health, physicians from Harvard and Johns Hopkins urged readers to consider the work of Porter and Jick, which showed clearly that fear of addiction in those with no past drug abuse didn't justify avoiding opiates, since the study showed that addiction among patients given these drugs in a hospital setting was extremely low. One researcher, writing in 1990 in Scientific American, called Porter and Jick an extensive study. A paper for the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement called Porter and Jick a landmark report. Then, the final anointing. Time magazine, in a 2001 story titled "Less Pain, More Gain," called Porter and Jick a landmark study, showing that the exaggerated fear that patients would become addicted to opiates was basically unwarranted. For years in medical schools, Marcia Stanton recalled, "I clearly remember instructors saying, 'Don't overdose, don't overdose, don't overdose. Don't make these patients addicted.' But now, here's this statistic. Look, oh, it's in print. It's gospel. I used Porter and Jick in lectures all the time. Everybody did. It didn't matter whether you were a physician, a pharmacist, or a nurse. You used it. No one disputed it. Should we have? Of course we should have. Everyone knew of opiates' pain-killing benefits. But how addictive were they? That was the question. Most doctors figured history and experience showed that the answer was very. Porter and Jick, as it was cited, suggested otherwise. So did Dr. Portnoy. Depending on the patient, he believed, these drugs might be used to great advantage. Portnoy was a pain management pioneer. In addition to his Beth Israel appointment, he was an editor-in-chief at the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, an editor at Pain, and on the editorial board of other medical journals. He would write numerous books, textbooks that students used in medical school. He was quoted often in newspapers. Above all, Portnoy took his message on the road to the kinds of association conferences where new ideas in medicine are proposed: the International Association for the Study of Pain, the American Pain Society, the American Academy of Pain Medicine. All of this helped create, by the mid-1990s, a new conventional wisdom that science had advanced, and now knew that opiates wouldn't addict a pain patient. Addicts and pain patients were two different things. With addicts, their quality of life goes down as they use drugs, one leading pain doctor, Scott Fishman, told New York Magazine in 2000. With pain patients, it improves. They're entirely different phenomena. This spelled bad times for the more complicated multidisciplinary approach to pain. Why, after all, was all that effort necessary if pain patients could be given pills with little risk of addiction? Patients, too, were hard to motivate when the treatment required behavior changes, such as more exercise. Pills were an easier solution. Multidisciplinary clinics began to fade. Over 1,000 such clinics existed nationwide in 1998. Only 85 were around 7 years later. Out in Seattle, Dr. John Loescher and his staff soldiered on at the University of Washington Center for Pain Relief, expanding on the ideas of John Bonica. But as insurance companies stopped paying for pain services, the university's medical center eliminated them. In 1998, Loescher resigned in disgust. The university eventually moved the historic clinic to a basement. There it remained, a game preserve of sorts for a few multidisciplinary holdouts who kept their heads down. A plastic surgery unit moved into the space the pain clinic once occupied. Use of opiates, meanwhile, changed medical thinking. Usually a patient demanding ever higher doses of a drug would be proof that the drug wasn't working. But in opiate pain treatment, it was taken as proof that the doctor hadn't yet prescribed enough. Indeed, some doctors came to believe that a pain patient demanding higher doses was likely to be exhibiting signs of pseudo-addiction, looking for a dose large enough to kill the pain, the cure for which was more opiates. Two doctors writing in 1989 in the journal Pain coined the term to describe the case of a 17-year-old suffering from leukemia, pneumonia, and chest pain, and asking for opiate painkillers, which physicians had misdiagnosed as addiction. One of the authors, J. David Haddix, later went to work at Purdue Pharma as vice president for health policy. The other, David Weissman, later described what doctors ought to do in cases of pseudo-addiction: build trust and aggressively increase the dose of opiates until pain was relieved, Weissman wrote. For all I know, pseudo-addiction may well be a real syndrome. But its importance to this story lies in that it helped nourish a growing body of thought that there was conceivably no limit to the amount of opiates a patient might need. Doctors might prescribe hundreds of milligrams a day. Certainly, according to the widely accepted misinterpretation of Porter and Chick, at least, there was minimal risk. No physician would simply go on with the same unsuccessful treatment, but that is what happens with opioids, said Loescher. Patients come and say, "That's great, doc, but I need more." The doctor gives them a higher dose. Then, 3 months later, they say the same thing, and so on. The point is, if it were working, you wouldn't need more. Nevertheless, a movement was born, radiating out from a simple one-paragraph statement in 1980. Other documents were used as well. Portnoy and Foley's own 1986 paper about 38 patients, citing Porter and Jick, was among them. So too was a 1982 survey of supervisors at 93 burn units that found no patients growing addicted to opiate painkillers, and a 1977 study of drug dependency in patients with chronic headaches. But it appears that none was cited, nor misinterpreted, as often as Porter and Jick. Dr. Herschel Jick, meanwhile, kept plumbing his ever-expanding patient databases. They could be, he believed, a source of clinically based information about drugs and their effects, something mankind had never possessed. He produced papers on a wide variety of topics. Whether oral polio vaccines cause a collapsing of the bowels in children, whether certain oral contraceptives cause blood clots in women, and on the origin of a mumps epidemic in England. All the while, his 1980 letter was sparking a movement. "It's an amazing thing," he said many years later. "That particular letter, for me, is very near the bottom of a long list of studies that I've done. It's useful as it stands because there's nothing else like it on hospitalized patients. But if you read it carefully, it does not speak to the level of addiction in outpatients who take these drugs for chronic pain." Enrique redeemed. Jalisco, Nayarit. One day in the fall of 1993, a tall, slender, light-skinned man in new cowboy boots and a cowboy hat low over his eyes boarded a bus in Nogales, Sonora, and headed south to his home in Nayarit. Enrique wore a new pair of dark blue Levi's 501s. His hat cost $500, his boots $1,000, at a Western wear shop in Phoenix, Arizona. He had another $15,000 in cash in his right pants pocket. His bus wound out of Nogales and down Mexico's Highway 15 that runs parallel to the Pacific coast. He sat wary of his surroundings, even when the driver put on a movie starring the comedian Cantinflas. He didn't watch it. He kept a hand on his right pants pocket and didn't dare sleep. The bus trip amounted to his redemption. Months before, as Enrique toiled in the sugarcane fields with his father and despaired of ever finding a way out of his poverty, he suddenly received and accepted an offer to work in Phoenix. A cell boss needed a driver for his heroin store. On his last day of work as a sugarcane farmer, he arrived at the sugar mill black from the soot and dust of the field, as if he stepped out of a coal mine. He took his bags of sugarcane and threw them as hard as he could onto the pile. "The next job I have is going to be for love of the work, not for need," he promised the foreman. The next day he kissed his mother and took a bus to Arizona. This was his chance. The San Fernando Valley, with his uncles working, would always limit him. He went to Phoenix eager to show his abilities. In a week he knew the streets, and before long he was running the store himself, cutting up the heroin, answering the beeper, and driving to deliver the balloons to the clients. His customers were mostly professional women, lawyers, nurses, a prostitute or two. He soon raised the store's daily take from $1,200 to $3,000. He worked from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m., grabbed a hamburger at a drive-thru, and was at home by 10 p.m. to balloon up the heroin for the next day. He didn't have time to clean his apartment or his clothes, and he made $5,000 that month. One day, his suppliers in Phoenix told him the boss would be arriving that night from Jalisco. This man impressed Enrique. He had a permit and could cross the border legally whenever he wanted. He was there to meet with his workers. As Enrique headed home that night, his beeper buzzed. He found a payphone. The big boss wanted McDonald's, a fish sandwich, before the meeting. Enrique scurried to get the food and returned to his apartment. He walked in as two gunmen had his boss and his suppliers in their underwear and on their knees in the bathroom. The invaders had found 2 ounces of heroin, jewelry, and some cash. Yet when they demanded more and placed a gun to his head, Enrique kept silent. That morning, he had packed tens of thousands of dollars in stacks of cash, but had no time to do anything with it. He put it at the bottom of a trash bag, overflowing with the detritus of his fast food diet, old French fries, pizza crust, used paper plates, and soda cans. If he told the gunman about the money, it would look like he'd set it all up. So he took their pistol whipping in silence, and they left with only $5,000 and those ounces of heroin, while at the bottom of that garbage bag was another $80,000 they didn't get. The boss, a grateful witness to this kid's loyalty, pulled him off the street and gave him 2 heroin drivers to supervise. Enrique worked harder. Business boomed. He sent money to his family to begin building a house for himself. When telephone service finally came to the Toad, he paid to make sure his family had a line installed in their house. 3 months after the robbery, Enrique was ready to return home. He bought his boots and hat and boarded that bus with the $15,000 in his pocket and his eyes wide open. Below the bus, he had stowed duffel bags bulging with clothes, jewelry, shoes, and VCRs. For so long, he had sought this magnificent return. He thought of his uncles in California who had sent him home with so little after working for so long. They hadn't the spine to make the business what it could be, or the vision to see what he was capable of. His new boss had vision. Enrique felt elated to have broken from the small world of his rancho. The clothes he brought home were Levi's 501s, Guess, Tommy Hilfiger, and Polo, measures of his success. His dad would have to remain silent. At 15, Enrique had been helping his family survive. Now, at 18, the heroin he sold in Phoenix allowed him to take over the job full-time. His family gathered him up at the bus station in Topeka. They drove him down the highway, through Jalisco, into their rancho. There, across the road from his childhood home, stood his new house, under construction and paid for with the money he had sent. It had two bedrooms, a full kitchen, a garage with an automatic door, a roof through which the rain never came, and a bathroom that was indoors. He felt at that moment that everything was possible, and he wanted to cry. Later, in his room with his mother, he pulled the cash out of his pocket and more from his sock. It fluttered onto the bed. "Did you rob someone?" "No," he said, smiling broadly. "It's mine." He noticed she didn't ask how he got it. He was sure she imagined. That night, he would always remember, was the first time his family had more than enough to eat. He brought out shirts, dresses, toys. His youngest sister called him Dad. The Arizona heroin business and his loyalty during the robbery won him new friends, and soon, invitations to parties in Jalisco thrown by the top heroin cell bosses. They had new cars and big houses. He felt ashamed of his petty dreams of the year before. In this world, men dreamed big. For the next 2 years, he split his time between his village and Phoenix, running his boss's heroin crews on the streets. He bought a used black Mercury Cougar. He took his girlfriend and his family to El Sarandeado, El Diamante, Topeka's best restaurants. He put his sister through college. She was the first in her family to graduate from college. He went into bars and restaurants and didn't think whether he could afford it. Freedom was what he felt, mostly. His mother no longer asked her husband for money to feed the family, nor endured his blows and insults in exchange. His father no longer had to depend on the mill to pay him. Over the years, merchants in town had learned many ways to put down the farmers who drew a living from the sugarcane and coffee and who constantly asked for credit. Now, for the first time, the baker smiled when Enrique's mother entered his shop and spoke warmly to her. He waved to Enrique's father when he passed. That year, at the Feria del Elote, Enrique and a friend who worked with him in Arizona owned the Central Plaza in Jalisco. The Saturday of the fair, they paid a banda $3,000 to play all night. They drank and offered alcohol to anyone who showed up. They only stopped because Mass at the cathedral was about to begin on Sunday morning. Jalisco had never seen that before from a couple guys from a rancho. Usually rancheros would save all year to pay for only 1 hour of banda music in the plaza. But heroin did that. It made everyone equal. It did not, however, endear Enrique to his girlfriend's father, who was happy to sell his meat to his mother, but didn't want an uneducated kid from the Toad, a chiva dealer, for a son-in-law. When Enrique was a boy, the butcher had been friendly. But since Enrique took up with his daughter, the man never spoke to him, and Enrique learned to keep his distance. In time, returning occasionally to Phoenix, and then a stint in Portland, then back home again, Enrique began to feel unsettled. His salary wasn't bad, but his expenses had risen now that he was spending so much time among all these new friends. He was limited. He could